Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me from, I believe he's in Taiwan, is Grant Newsham. Grant, good evening, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Good evening and good morning, yes.
You continue to work in Taipei, yes?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a Taipei question then. They seem to me to be legitimizing something with their contest with the World Health Organization. And I don't know if legitimizing is the right word, but they certainly are calling to everybody's attention, I think, the rightness of their position and the unfairness that they've been treated in the world community simply because China decides it is that way. Am I reading that wrong? Am I reading too much into it? What do you see?
Well, you're certainly reading it like any decent civilized person on the planet would. You know, here you have Taiwan, which tried to sound the alarm, was begging to be listened to back when this disease brewed up. They were not listened to simply because of pure spite on China's part. And you can do the math from that point. You know, 20,000 dead Americans and counting. What's the global count? A lot higher than that. And it is all because of this, this just absolute barbarity on China's part in keeping Taiwan excluded from the WHO and from any other normal sort of activity which they should be a part of as a what is effectively a democratic, consensually run, free Chinese democracy. There is no nice way to put it. And it's really it stands out in just really stark contrast to what the Chinese have done and what they've done to the world. And the fact is that the Taiwanese have the evidence of what they did, what they tried to do. So you can actually see cause and effect here. China, you know, plays its games with Taiwan, and as a result, the entire world suffers. Every one of us suffers from it. So it's hard to see, you know, if this won't wake up the world, I don't think anything will, or wake up, so to say, decent people, really to the reality of Taiwan and the reality of the People's Republic of China. It's a stark contrast. It's interesting that it's this virus which has once again brought it to the fore, but it's put it right in the front of everybody's noses, and it's as plain as day.
The I think Taiwan has acquitted themselves, you know, in a dignified manner, but their relentless devotion to the truth, to me, I think is casting them in a different light vis-a-vis, the nation that has given us, as you said, every one of us. I mean, I when you said that, you know, it struck me. I had a little business, you know, going around speaking and helping people with mental health, especially people on the backside of traumatic events. You know, how do you do this? And that business has come to a screeching halt, and I'm now having to find ways to deliver it, by webinar and to get into the distance learning business, because as capitalists, right, when God closes a door, right, you got to break the window. So, I'm impacted financially, certainly by that. And as you said, everybody around the world is. So this brings a next question. Do you think at some point, as the dust settles, do you think that nations will look at the Chinese and say, we want some sort of relief for what you did, not only to our population, but what you did to the gross domestic product of our country? This could have been prevented. You're culpable in this, as opposed to had it just started, you know, like other pandemics do, it started and then spread, and there was no culpability that could have been assigned to that. It's one of those things that happens. But this clearly, as I heard somebody say, you know, as soon as the first person went to the hospital and one of the people in the hospital got sick, you knew it was, you know, transmissible person to person, which would have happened November, December in Wuhan. And so anyway, do you think if I ask you to look into your crystal ball, and I'm writing your answer down just so you know, do you think the Chinese will, you know, be called upon to in some way, shape or form, compensate nations for what they've done?
Well, the calls are already coming. It's a question of if anyone remembers how long this lasts, and also if anyone pushes this. You find that governments oftentimes come up with a lot of reasons not to do what they should do, and there's a sense of, oh, let's just let bygones be bygones. You can't really sue a country like this, et cetera, et cetera. But there's never been anything quite like this where the cause and effect is so obvious. You can debate whether or not there's legal recourse against the People's Republic of China for what they've done. And there is any competent lawyer could come up with a ski or sort of right. a theory for suing them as a nation. Whether or not that would succeed, who knows? But if you could get them in, you know, handling so many suits and having to pay lawyers, especially Western American lawyers at, you know, $5,000 an hour, you could probably bankrupt the entire country. I'm joking a little bit, of course, but not by much.
Well, let me ask you. So
do it on principle, and that's often enough.
So the pushback, though, from the Chinese would be their pushback is always, do you really want to do this? Do you know that we will begin to pinch, right? You know, let's just say the UK, who's clearly not happy. Let's just say the UK says, you know, we want some form of compensation for what you've done, right? And the Chinese will say, you know, that's going to cost you your import business to China, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the game that's always played, the economic extortion game. And, you know, normally that makes it go away.
Well, that's one of the concerns, you know, we should have, because every, you know, we do. You know, the damage this is causing is right in front of everyone's faces. But if somehow this, you know, sort of gets back on track or kind of looks like it's recovering, there is a tendency on a lot of people's part, particularly in the government and politics, the business world, to say just let it ride and we'll get over it, just like with Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. So that's
what
human
mean?
Nature.
What do you mean? But, I thought that did not exist.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I was early in the morning, so I think it was leprechauns telling me.
I think
about
you're
it.
Mistaken about that. I don't know that that actually happened.
Yeah, but you know how we are, but how humans are. But you're going to hear that. What you've described is the Chinese sort of pushback, the extortion. Well, if you make us, you know, if you pressure us, then we're going to, you know, close down all your businesses in China. We won't let you have more business. And they're going to do it. They've already started doing it. And I'm just waiting for somebody, you know, with a backbone, who's someone who's not a complete invertebrate in our ruling class, to say, okay, go ahead. We can live without China. We lived very well without you. And really, we didn't start selling out to China until 1989. How did the United States of America survive? Before that, you know, we'll do it again. And that's really what it, once you see this people, a few people who matter will just finally wake up and say, we don't need China. That then you can see a strategic shift in how things are. But it does take some people to wake up, and certainly the population en masse could do it. Like if you don't go to Walmart for a couple of weeks and tell Walmart, okay, start making the stuff in Bentonville, Arkansas, like you used to,
right,
or someone else. It is possible that if enough people are angry enough, say like 20 million unemployed people, to stop going to Walmart and buying all this stuff from China, that's one way to apply pressure. But once again, our elected representatives have a responsibility here. We'll say if they do what they need to do. It's that's some
well, you
say.
Know, but there's a glimmer of hope, because if it becomes some kind of populist event, then they'll all want to do it, right?
Well, they kind of do that. Whatever works, but
right.
And that would probably be more likely than waiting for a lot of the, say our elected representatives to do the right thing.
Right.
But there are people who are certainly onto this. That, you know, once again, Marco Rubio is one.
Oh my God.
Comes immediately to mind. So there are people on Capitol Hill. There are people who are know what happened here. They know who did it, and they're not happy. So there, it's not as if everybody up there is, you know, fast asleep. So we'll see how it goes. But the, you know, if you think of all the incidents that have happened, you know, over the last 30, 50 years or 45 years, to ask us why we should be dealing with China, with this, the People's Republic of China run by the Chinese Communist Party. You know, this is, I can't think of a similar event. This is even worse than Tiananmen Square. There is no excuse for what they've done. And maybe out of this, Taiwan will, you know, actually get some benefit from it. And, you know, they are, you don't need every country, because so many of these little sort of lesser account countries are in China's back pocket, or pocketbook at least. But there's if you can get enough of sort of civilized countries together, and some of them are showing some pretty that they're not very happy with what's happened, that they Taiwan could come out of this better than it was going in.
Well, that was certainly my thought when I saw, you know, this dispute, and all Taiwan does is stand on the truth. No. It wasn't like that, and the World Health. Why is the World Health Organization, you know, seemingly so beholden to China?
Well, if you look in probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 dozen Swiss bank accounts, that will probably answer it for you.
Oh, damn it.
That's not a hard question. I mean, this would be like the final exam for my math class asking me what's 7 plus 3. it's pretty obvious. And like everybody knows this.
Hey, can I tell you something?
You're
the first person that has ever used the word invertebrate on this program, just so you know.
Okay, well, I heard it from somebody else. Did you plead the case?
Congratulations. Congratulations. You watch it, and so it's like, okay, well, the United States is giving you, what, $400 million a year, and China's giving you $40, and yet the you know, you're parroting, right? I mean, I'm not even a health person, right? And you know enough to say, yeah, that's wrong, though. And then you watch them on TV, and you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the like the International Olympic Committee, or the people who decide where the FIFA, you know, World Tournament's going to be. Why is it?
It's right? Probably not that corrupt.
Why is it going to be? Why is this soccer tournament going to be in gutter? It's like 190 degrees there. They won't be able to function. No, yeah. It'll be fine. We have assurances. It'll be fine.
No, the way it works is, once again, this isn't even complicated. You take the WHO. China cultivates its guys. You know, it gets its people into these organizations, and instead of seeing themselves as sort of above national interests or sort of global bureaucrats, they see themselves as Chinese people working to advance the benefits of the People's Republic of China, nothing more. But then you do get your own foreign nationals who are, once again, your guys. And this Tedros fellow who runs the place is just, he's exhibit A, B, C, D, all the way to Z. He is as classic an example of it as you can. Completely incompetent and venal. That was just before he even got to the World Health Organization. So they made quick work of him. He gets both his position and his money as a result of what the People's Republic of China does. So who is he dependent on? Plus the fact that after he took over, he made Robert Mugabe, the murderer who was, tormented Zimbabwe for all those years. They made him a World Health Organization goodwill ambassador. So what's the question here? Well, are you either stupid or are you just like Mugabe? Take your pick. And so that that really told you plenty. But he has performed up to Chinese expectations. But it's almost embarrassing to watch. No, it isn't embarrassing. It's fun to watch when he does, you know, to watch him pull off this Baghdad Bob regime routine, but without, I'd say, without the IQ. That it, you know, so he's the evidence is so overwhelming, just based on statements and the timing of it. And just the, what he said, that it's hard to imagine, you know, why he just doesn't sit in Beijing and have them sort of somehow pipe in his words. It really is disgraceful. It's discrediting the World Health Organization as if that was possible. And by extension, the United, broader United Nations. But we are getting to see this on display, and we'll see how it plays out. You know, memories often tend to fade pretty quickly with a lot of people, but in this case, the damage is so widespread and the death count is so high that it's, you know, if we, as I say, free, civilized people and our representatives overlook this or let it, just let it go, I'll be disappointed.
There's stories coming out that China is attempting to or is not cooperating with research into the origins of the virus. Have you seen those stories? And
yes, yes.
What is? Could you explain that to us?
It's what those these stories are ones where you really don't have to read much beyond the headlines. And not being funny or glib, but if you look at China, and if you're going to analyze things Chinese, the fundamental principle, the baseline from which you have to operate is that the Chinese communists lie, period. And once you understand that, everything else makes sense. That, and if you don't start with that, and you think of that the Chinese are just a bunch of, you know, 1.4 billion Canadians who look a little different than Canadians, except for Vancouver, that if you will never be right. You will be wrong about anything you try to figure out about China. So you assume they lie. And if there is any sort of, if they have a choice between telling the truth and in as a result, making the Chinese Communist Party look bad, look less than omniscient or omnipresent or omnipotent, perfect, or telling the truth and or not telling the truth and lying and making the Chinese Communist Party look good, they're going to take the one that makes them look good. And that means they will lie. If whenever there's a choice between one or the other, they will take the one that makes them look, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, look good. And if that's a lie, so be it. And they will keep that going for an ad in forever. And that is so that's what's going on here. You know, if they were just based on what we know, you know, what's been reported just in the press and open source, that there is no other way to look at this, that the misbehavior, the just wrongdoing of the Chinese Communist Party is what has gotten us into this mess. And there's no other way around that. So any research, the more you dig into it, the more obvious it gets. It's not like the news is going to get better. You're going to find some facts that exonerate the Chinese Communist Party and make the People's Republic of China look good. So they're going to keep at this, and it'll take some Herculean effort to get to the truth. And one imagines that at some point, somehow, that it will sort of sneak out of China, because there are, you know, there's no shortage of decent Chinese people. This stuff does tend to get out. You know, as information about organ harvesting, for example, has gradually leaked out, information about the mistreatment of the Muslim minorities in East Turkestan, in west part of what is the sort of the west part of China, it does tend to get out, but they're not going to let it come out the easy way. So I say once again that the headline of that story said it all.
I want to read you an email. This guy's like your biggest fan. If I don't have you on like every 2 or 3 weeks, this guy sends me an email. Hey.
Well, that's my brother, actually.
He does live in the D.C. Baltimore area. your favorite place.
Oh no. Okay.
I believe China is in deeper shit than even they realize. They tried to hide the virus because that's how they control local problems. They couldn't, and they thought by controlling manufacturing and many key products, steel, phones, pharmaceuticals, they had the world by the balls. Well, they don't. Our creativity and passion, when we are organized, will change that. And for too many years, we had our heads in the ground, letting them build dams, etc. The Mekong River is one example. But we did that here 100 years ago. Kissinger is one of the main causes for our China problems. Grant believes that Republicans and Democrats are both guilty. Unfortunately, our D.C. leadership has no well-thought-out strategy now and hasn't had one for a while. One flamethrower guy shooting from the hip to get TV ratings is not a strategy. So this is what the nations of the region live with on a daily basis. Can you explain to us the Mekong River thing?
Okay, well, thanks. I could start with that. Yeah, I was hoping the question would be, what's 7 plus 3?
I'll get to that. 10.
Okay, but there's a lot to that, and it's all on the money, to my way of thinking. The Mekong River thing is... once again, it's pretty easy to figure out when you think about it. The Chinese have built a lot of dams higher up the Mekong River in China. And they've been trying to build them actually in some of their satellite countries down below. But in China, we'll do it. That'll be enough. And if you have a dam up the river and you don't let water out, it tends to provide less water downstream. You know, that's the deal, sort of like the Colorado River. If you're down in Mexico, there's not a whole lot left by the time it gets there. And so that's combined with a natural drought, which has come along, that there's not enough water downstream in the countries that the Mekong flows through, Vietnam, Cambodia, etc. And that is a result of damming this thing. And so there's been people pointing this out, including some U.S. government types, for a long time. I mean, it goes back at least 30 years, you know, who were sounding the alarm, were writing reports on what is going to happen once China builds these dams. And so, but once again, there's another sort of thing that's helpful for understanding PRC behavior. It's a Chinese expression that translates it's like, you die, I live. It's very much a peasant mentality way of going about life, but it really does explain a lot of things. And the idea is that, you know, if there's something that will benefit China, it really doesn't matter what harmful effects there are on anyone else. And you're seeing that with the dams that block off the Mekong River. Once again, you could see it coming. And it's also obviously another aspect of this is, well, if you want leverage on somebody, say, well, if you're going to have to do what we say, support us at the UN or, you know, what have you. Don't let the Americans come and train. You can apply this political pressure by threatening to withhold water. And that is part of the game as well. So this is finally coming to fruition, water blackmail or extortion, and this has been predicted for a long time, but the hardware is finally in place, and then you combine it with some climactic circumstances, a drought, and you see the results of it. So that's sort of what's going on with the river. The email's underlying premise that the China PRC is in bigger trouble than they're letting on is the right one. But if you read some of our so-called mainstream media in the U.S., you would think, well, they've got the virus licked.
Right.
They only had 3,000 people die. Right. And if you read it, and they've got, 70% of their businesses back online, they've had this huge V-shaped recovery. that if you would think, boy, by Jove, these, you know, that China's really done it right. But if you just take the opposite, if you discount that by about 80-90%, you're probably much closer to the truth. And so, one, they haven't got everything back online. They have, it isn't, it, unlike their claims, that they didn't take a month and a half to take on and send the virus packing. They announced they did because they saw that if they didn't, that if they didn't declare victory and try and claim the economy was going again, they would suffer even more damage. So their industry business is not back at all what it was. It's, I don't even think it's on the right track. But another and part of all of this is the that's really always worth listening thinking about is that suppose magically that, you know, just say once again, leprechauns were at work and they could somehow get Chinese industry humming again and just everything back to normal. And they're making all this stuff for export. Who's going to buy it? You look at these other countries around the world, which are almost flat on their back, and they're not very interested or even able to buy Chinese exports. So if you combine really the reality, which is China's economy is not back on its feet, and then you combine that with even if with there being hardly not much demand for whatever China makes, that they've got a really a considerable problem. And despite what they say, but you're just not going to get an honest appraisal of anything out of China. Even when there were a few Western reporters there, they were limited in what they could say. There was only so much they could cover. So it's unfortunate that on our side, so much of our media does sort of pass along uncritically the sort of positive reports by the Chinese Communist Party. So it's as the email said, yeah, they've got some problems. You know, and we'll see how we respond to this. You know, this is, you know, I can't think of any, this is a lot bigger than 9/11 to my way of thinking. America's done pretty well in the past. The Japanese miscalculated the U.S. In 1941 and thought we would just sort of roll over and sort of cut a deal after they hammered us once. But that didn't work out that way. We'll see if, you know, this generation, you know, has, you know, some of the, our, actually vertebrate people like the like our predecessors were.
Not a trivia question. I was watching something the other night about Iwo Jima, and for the first time in my life, I saw a Japanese ensign who was captured, part of the naval infantry that was ashore on Iwo Jima, and he survived the battle. And he talked about the sacrifice of the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, I've been in discussions where, you know, the question was dropping the atomic bomb ultimately a humane act? Now, as completely upside down as some people would believe that statement was, I mean, I believe that it's true. I never heard anybody that's Japanese say that, though, until this man talked about, you know, we were prepared to fight to the end. And he said, and I believe that the sacrifice of Hiroshima and Nagasaki saved the Japanese people from a horrendous fate that would have befallen because we would have never surrendered. You spent a fair amount of time in Japan. Is that something they talk about? Is that a widely held sentiment? I'm sure you probably had a discussion or two about that.
It's not a widely spoken sentiment, but I think you will find it is a, if not widely understood, if anyone asks and people think about it, but it's not as if the Japanese people can't figure it out, but particularly ones from that era, you know, the more time passes, the more people have a sense of that. And the the idea of Japan as victim, with the two atom bombs being representative of that, it's widespread. It's internalized because that's what's been taught in the schools for a long, long time. And people kind of grow up with that. It's almost an idea that, well, you know, one day out of the blue in August 1945, the Americans came and dropped two bombs. We have no real idea why they did it. Poor Japan. So that's the sort of the official line, and it's internalized to a degree. But you'll find, you know, especially people who were alive then, and especially, I would say, civilians, you know, who were being starved to death, that you don't have to scratch too hard to find people who will say, yeah, that's kind of right. Thank goodness they did drop it, though they'll never say that in public.
Right.
Just a story, you know, I think I know the fella that you saw interviewed, partly because there's not many of them. You know, if they only, right, what, 500 survivors and
right,
499 of them pulled half dead out of bomb craters. That I met him once. I'm sure it's him. Because he was a naval, like a warrant officer or such like. And I was the Marine attaché at the embassy in Tokyo. And it's kind of a funny, interesting story. And there was going to be a ceremony, as there is every year, for the on Iwo Jima. And the Japanese were going to, as they do, send a group. And one of the organizers, who himself was a survivor of the battle, he wanted to bring one of his friends along. Who was another survivor. And this is like, you know, being, you know, given a choice of like meeting a smart University of Southern California graduate just out of sheer, you know, you don't get to do it often. And so he brought they came to the embassy and they came to the attaché's office. And since I was the Marine, I was the one to meet him. And I opened the door to the DAO office, and I had actually put on my Alpha uniform.
Yes.
Like for like the fourth time since leaving Quantico, as I thought it appropriate. And I opened the door, and there was this little white-haired Japanese gentleman in front of me. And he looked up like he had seen a ghost. And he actually, he kind of went, sort of pulled back a little bit. And then he reached out carefully, and he touched my uniform sleeve and sort of tugged on it as if to see if this was real. And it was quite something that to see the reaction. I mean, this could have been one of the first times he had ever been face to face with a Marine, really since those days. But he was a good, thoughtful guy in our later conversation. So if it's the same guy, and it just might be, I'm not surprised that he would say something like this. But it's not, if you were to come to Tokyo and sort of, yeah, I don't know, meet any, you know, sort of meet a Japanese politician or reporter or somebody and, you know, say such a thing, you would probably be put on the second flight out of town. But in terms of people being around who understand that, yes, there's plenty who do realize, especially if they were alive then, and you will hear them talk about that. If you were to, you know, and they will actually very clearly say, yeah, there's no way we would have surrendered. It's what we were being told to do, and we'd have all died. Once again, some time passes and a narrative takes over,
right,
of Japan as pure victim. And it's a hard thing to challenge, but you won't even find people on the U.S. side who will say that.
No.
Well, you will, but...
Right. It was interesting. My daughter, it came up because my daughter was involved in debate. And so she was telling me about, you know, they were debating whether the ends justify the means or the means justify the end. And I think her side of the debate was the means don't justify the end. So she was talking about, well, she said the other side is going to use, you know, the dropping of the atomic bomb and all that. And I said, well, Colleen, you need to research that, because ultimately, you know, ultimately that's a humane act. And she looked at me like, what? I said, no, if you look at the planning estimates, you know, for the operation, they were estimated that there would be 10 million Japanese dead of all military and non-military, and there would be 2 million American casualties, of which approximately 25%, or about 500,000, would be killed in action. So you talk about 12 million casualties were the estimates that President Truman was presented with. And then these two bombs, caused somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 killed immediately, and others would die over time. But, it's not even close. I said, now, nobody would say that, right? And she looked at me and she said, no, I didn't really know all that. I said, so if they do bring it up, you could crush them with that information.
To me, the logic is clear. It's a choice between a bad choice and a really horrible choice.
Right. Grant, it was interesting because going back to kind of the Iwo Jima aspect of this, I saw it, and there's a video on Amazon Prime called Iwo Jima. I want to say it says something like The Boys of Company H or something like that. And it was interviewing guys who were in hotel company. What would that have been? 3rd Battalion, 28th Marines. So they go across the base of Suribachi. They support the attacking up and the flag raisings. And then they head up the west side of the island with the rest of 28th Marines and the 5th Marine Division. So they then talk about when they're done, they go back to Hawaii, and now everybody's preparing for the invasion of Japan. Well, they're reading about Okinawa as they head home, and the casualty numbers they're off the hook. And Okinawa, 82 days, right? And then we were sitting around talking about, does anybody believe that if we land on Japan, that any of us are going to get through it? And the answer was, nah. And one guy said, my luck ran out on Iwo Jima. And I knew that if we went ashore on Japan, there was no way I'd get through that. I had been too lucky already. So it's really interesting to hear their perspective about the atomic bomb.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, the whole, with that being in sort of those circumstances. Harry Truman, the president, said he never lost a night's sleep after making the decision. But there is, in a way, as is always the case, after anything like this, the critics come out, and it was debated at the time, even before they dropped it. Is there some alternative to this? It's not like people woke up one morning and said, let's go drop this bomb, but it was debated. But afterwards, the arguments become even stronger, particularly by people who weren't going to be on the assault waves. The idea, well, the submarine blockade was working so well, we could have just starved them into submission. Or the casualty figures are wildly they're just wildly inflated. Wouldn't have been that bad. Once again, the farther you are from the actual participating in the assault, things look a lot differently. But it's an interesting sort of debate, as you've noted, when you have the tough choices and you're not going to get off scot-free from either of them. Which one do you do? Another aspect of it, which I've always been interested in, because I'm interested in the prisoner of war experience, both particularly military, but also civilian prisoners. There were tens of thousands of them, and a lot of them Americans and British and Australians even more. By 1945, these people were at the end of their rope, and they were dying.
Well, hold on. Talking about American civilians that were held in Japan?
Those would be more down in the Philippines. But there were not civilians in Japan that I'm aware of, but elsewhere in Asia, say in Indonesia, once again, the Philippines, Singapore, not so many Americans, but certainly allied, British, Australian, Dutch, etc. And then you had the military POWs in Japan and all the way down to Indonesia and up into Thailand, that they were just at the end of their rope and were dying like flies. The longer the war went, they were going to die. And then the other one is, part of this is that it's well known, though nobody will talk about it, that the orders had gone out, if the Americans invade Japan, kill all the prisoners. And this is well known. And so if you're making the atom bomb decision, sometimes that factors into the equation. But you don't hear anyone mention that very often, is that if they had not dropped it, you should have expected to lose 90%+ of the POWs that the Japanese had, which to me it weighs in favor of dropping them. And this is, it's not a, one doesn't want to be funny about it or take it lightly. If I had cast my vote, I think I would have voted to drop it. As horrific as it is, and there is no nice way to put this.
Right.
But the POW angle, you never hear it mentioned much. But right. they were all going to be killed if they didn't starve to death. So. Yeah.
Right. No, I don't think that discussion goes much further than the casualty estimates at that point. It's like, all right, how many do we have? Only two. Okay, well, we hope that after we do this that something changes. I want to ask you, and we kind of got into it a little bit last time you were on, but the more I read about the Commandant's planning guidance and the Army's expeditionary, base operation thing, and the Navy's pivot to the Pacific and the Pacific Defense Initiative, which is, thought to be following the path of the European Defense Initiative, right, which has got us much closer to nations like Poland, the Baltic Republics, conducting larger and more frequent military exercises. So with our closer diplomatic and economic relationships with those countries in Europe came closer military, and which serves as a greater deterrent to Russia in terms of, should they do anything. So my question for you is, can there be any hope of, fighting inside the weapons engagement zone if there isn't, close economic and diplomatic relationships with Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, the nations in the region? How could you possibly do that if you don't have, if it's a non-permissive environment?
I think you've really got to the heart of what I see as one of the biggest challenges of what the Commandant is proposing. And that is, if you're going to put these smaller, marine units into other places, other countries in Asia, say Asia, for example, but also anywhere else on Earth, and then arm them with long-range precision weapons, and move them, make them hard to spot, hard to target, and move them around a lot. That it kind of helps if people will let you come in there, and it helps if they will let you come in before the fighting starts, and when it's sort of peacetime these days, or. It's debatable, but it's certainly not a shooting war. And so how do you actually get other countries wanting and willing to have you come and sort of get ready? And that's the key to so much of this. And it has never, I think we're seeing that we really haven't done the necessary groundwork for it. Now, I would submit that the Marine Corps itself has not done what it needed to do. In places where it could have made a difference, but you right on target that it's more than just a military issue. That if somebody's going to sort of effectively side with the Americans and the free world, that they're going to have a reason to do it, other than some 3-star general came and had tea with the chief of their general staff. And that's where I don't like the expression, but I'll use it anyway because it's early, whole of government sort of applies. It's not just the U.S. military, but the political world, our business world, the diplomats, they all have to, it's got to be working together like the fingers on your hand to pick up a cup where everything sort of synchronizes, and you've got to see this as a larger effort to give people a reason to side with us. And that can, it's just as effective if they have, you know, an economic reason for doing it. If they see us as being the ones who can actually guarantee their political independence from Chinese and Russian pressure. But it requires a civilian and military and business and economic approach, and I would say a propaganda approach, which is in the good original Jesuit meaning of the word, which is simply explaining yourself. You know, you do have to sell what America and the free world has to offer. People just don't intuitively figure it out. So it requires us to do a number of things together, and so that we can actually get our forces in a position and, you know, to be able to sort of operate the way the commandant has in mind. And even if it wasn't a case of, you know, I would suggest even if the commandant wasn't proposing anything different, you would still want to have that. It's right. Not just access. You want to have a intense desire to have the Americans around to help maintain freedom. Sort of the, if you remember how the Europeans were in the after World War II, when there was a real fear of the Russians, they were very glad to have us around. And it wasn't just military, but we also were smart enough to harness the economic and the political as well. And the same kind of goes for actually Japan, believe it or not, and right. South Korea. But you've hit on it. I think more to me, at least, the debate over whether or not what the commandant is proposing is the right thing or not. I come down a certain way, but I think even more important is the need to be able to get into these countries and to have them to want us to be there, to perform our magic, and ideally with them pulling the weight as well, or some weight. That's the thing that I think needs a lot of attention, and the military and the Marines have a role. We're not the only ones, but it has to be sort of a broader effort.
To me, you know, as you go down this road of, you know, diplomatic overtures, economic engagement, you know, greater trade, greater profitability, right, for their nation, then ultimately that's how military cooperation begins. What impact does it have for that whole equation if the United States is welcomed and three of the four, you know, the Philippines, assuming there at some point there's regime change there, Vietnam and Malaysia or Indonesia, if there's American forces that are welcome there, that exercise there, how does that change the whole equation in the South China Sea?
It kind of turns the South China Sea into this really big bathtub for the Chinese. You know, you can go in it, but try getting out of it. Or use some World War I example where it's a bit like no man's land where nobody quite owns it, but you're ill-advised to try to attack through it. And that's where if we are welcomed into those countries, that the geography is such that we would create our own, what do they call it, WEZ, the weapon employment zone.
Or we would create a situation that you would never even attempt to do it because you're essentially going to have to fight from the Chinese mainland. You're not, you know, can you imagine if we were exercising on boats with the, you know, the Filipino Marines and the Vietnamese Marines, and we were out there amongst it all on a regular basis, you know, with our partners and under the guise of, you know, international training and doing the things we do, that we were then part of the quote unquote little green men, you know, as it was unfolding. Because you made a comment about 5 minutes ago about, well, when we're not really at war, so to speak, but we are. But the tools of war that the Chinese are waging are economic, and their fishing boats, you know, and just what in the last week they rammed and sunk another Vietnamese fishing boat, and it is the same game that Vladimir Putin played in the Crimea, You know, no patches. They're not part of the Russian military. Not really sure where they came from, you know, but somehow other, you know, they're influencing world events, and now we're going to annex the Crimea. If, I mean, so to be engaged is that would American forces, special, conventional, whatever, would be in the vicinity, would be part of that, and you'd be in that game, but you can't do that in a non-permissive environment. And so to me, Donald Trump says he doesn't like, you know, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He'd rather have bilateral agreements. But we haven't seen, right, us cut a great bilateral agreement yet with anybody other than China.
Yeah.
Does the real estate guy from Queens need to get off his ass and energize this? Because I'll take you to the next question. I believe post-COVID-19, the United States and the free world is going to have a window to tell China you need to behave according to the rules of the rules-based order, which they seek to usurp around the world. And based on what you've done, I think there is a window that maybe, you know, I won't say that they could be brought to heel, but there's a window that the rules-based international order is going to be able to be advanced in a broad way in front of a lot of countries around the world. Yay? Nay?
Yeah, I think I agree with you on all of those. The window is really the one that needs to be paid attention to, because after any event or incident, that no matter how horrific, we tend to forget as time passes. You forget the intensity of it and the lessons of it. And if we don't strike, say, hard or fast after it, then as time passes, you know, you can think of all sorts of reasons not to do anything. And so I am, you know, one does hope that, you know, that we've, you know, as we've, you know, us writ large, and that we've learned our lesson from this and we take advantage of it. But it is definitely a window. And if you don't move, it'll close and your opportunity will be gone. What you've described is it's the right way of looking at it. To my way of thinking is that you've got to have this. It isn't just a military thing of people letting us come in and do an exercise once again and saying how much we love each other, because we've been doing that for 60 years throughout the region. You know, with, you know, what are we on, like on Cobra Gold 30, whatever, you know, whatever. Right. You know, we've right. been doing these exercises, some of them up in the 50s.
Right.
And yet we still don't. Yeah, we still don't have anywhere we can really operate freely.
Right.
So we haven't been doing something right, and we haven't been keeping scores to what our what our position really is.
Well, Grant, I saw something that the Chinese are more than that said the Chinese are more than content to play that game, because the thing that they remind everybody is notice the Americans left again. They always leave. Look around the world, right? They get their nose bloodied and they leave. So just know this: we will always be here. They will leave. And so your point is exactly, you know, spot on, you know, that they.
But you also have, you know, you have the Chinese, it's sort of an economic offensive as well. And
right.
just diverting just for a minute, that you did, what you mentioned is, you know, what I'd said, well, it's not a shooting war at least. But if you were to ask the Chinese, are you at war with the Americans? They'd say, yeah.
Right.
You know, are you, how dumb are you? And of course we are. It's just we're doing it in our own way. But they see this as the start of a war. And the Japanese military, oddly enough, is well aware of this. I once heard a Japanese general really just cut the legs off of a U.S. Army general who claimed that we were in this phase zero peacetime. And the Japanese guy really just laid – he took him apart on this. And the Japanese see this as we are in – phase one, as they put it, you know, it's already started. But you do find it's the economic assault, and it's that, and it's almost, I call it the being there result or effect, which is so strong with what the Chinese do, you know, because you've just got Chinese people all over the place. Philippines, you've got something like 3 million Chinese citizens have been allowed into the Philippines to do whatever they do. Generally, it's taking over a lot of small businesses, et cetera. But you got them into the woodwork now. It's 3 billion since Duterte took over.
Right.
Go down to the Pacific Islands, and you've had large numbers of Chinese once again coming in. They take over the sort of the street corner, the shops. They start working with local organized crime and with Chinese organized crime too to exert influence. They buy off the politicians, and this is all done without without hardly any Chinese military activity in the Pacific Islands, but the ability to sort of take over, to subvert and dominate quietly under the guise of really economic activity and this migration is really can't be overlooked. The Solomon Islands is an excellent example where they switched, this was last year, switched recognition from Taiwan to China. Even though the U.S. had tried to get them not to, and that was the result of this quiet Chinese invasion of the country, and you see it throughout Asia, you see it in Europe as well, just Africa, just Latin America, just about everywhere. So that is part of the equation, and it's something that needs to be. We need to recognize it and also figure out how we are going to provide one counter it, but provide a better alternative. You can't just keep telling people, well, don't deal with the Chinese, don't deal with the PRC. Well, then, you know, from their perspective, well, what's our option here? And that's something that we need to do a much, much better job on, so working with our friends also. But you mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a sort of an economic agreement that was going to bring in a lot of Asia and even some South American countries, which... really, it's unfortunate that it didn't go. In fairness, that woman, Mrs. Clinton, was against it also. It wasn't just Mr. Trump was the one who stopped it, but also the Obama administration did not push it with any heart. They weren't serious about getting it passed. But it had nothing to do with military things. But it was all about economic ties. And really, it would have created almost a U.S. and our friends or aligned countries, their own sort of trade network. Not just the economic benefits of it probably were some, but it was as much as anything a psychological sort of thing that showed that there is an alternative to becoming entangled in this Chinese web. And it's unfortunate that it didn't pass. It would be nice to if it could be resuscitated, at least from the point of the Americans getting involved. And, you know, for the political advantage, the psychological strength and ties which come of that. So that's always it's a possibility. But I think it's as essential as getting the military end right as well. So
I don't think you can get the military piece right if you don't get the economic piece right. I think that fighting as all the stuff of, you know, we're going to somehow or other sneak around the region with Chinese everywhere in a non-permissive environment,
I agree. And if you think you're going to do it, say, with huge MAGTAFs or, you know, amphibious groups, you're going to have to somehow figure out how to become invisible,
right.
Just with sort of overhead, with sort of surveillance being what it is. It's going to be hard to operate big units with big things and not be spotted and whapped as a result.
Well, so how about any unit, Grant? Because the Chinese, they will have people on the take in terms of people who run ports, people who are captains of ships, anybody who interfaces with the United States. All those people will be on the take. They will be expected to provide information to their, you know, Chinese handlers, if you will. You will have millions of Chinese in the region that will do what they're supposed to do. And so I don't know. I read this stuff that is written about, you know, advanced expeditionary bases and all the rest of that stuff. And be it coming out of the Army, the Navy, or the Marine Corps. And I just think so if the president doesn't like, you know, multinational agreements and these group agreements, then negotiate bilateral ones. But you've got to create an incentive for Vietnam economically, you know, maybe in conjunction with the EU, Canada, and Mexico, and to say, hey, look, you know, we would all like to have better relationships with you. We understand the pressure you're on, and we want to create, you know, strong either bilateral or multinational agreements with you, which has to be the precursor for anything else, because now they can tell, you know, China, hey, screw you. And we don't need to play with you because we have all these other nations that will play with us. And so to me, without that piece, I just look at all this planning and I think, you know what? If they dominate the region, you are not going to go in with a peer and take it back, you know, like, you know, in coveralls, walking around the port, you know, looking like Americans, like saying nothing to see here. That ain't going to work.
I think you got it. You know, they, you know, not that you need me to tell you, but you're going to have to work that, the counterintelligence end of it. It's one way to look at it. You can't work that unless you're in where the locals want you.
Right.
If the locals are on our side, then you can get some freedom of action. But if you think you're just going to slide in as on top of a place that's already been subverted by the Chinese, that's going to be a hard. Don't count on it. But somehow you need to address that to get people to be on our side. That is going to take a lot more than what the military can do. But it does require the U.S. to really get the political, diplomatic, economic part right. And I haven't really seen much evidence that we're very good at that, unfortunately. You know, we just one, it's a funny example that, you know, you hear it a lot, is that, you know, we've put these tariffs on, say, Chinese goods, and then we're asking other countries to, you know, buy more of our stuff to make up for, because we're not selling as much to China. And you know, they kind of say, well, yeah, we'd like to, but do you think you could reduce the tariffs on our stuff? So the tariffs have hit our friends just as much as they have the Chinese. And then we come in with this chutzpah, or they just some nerve to tell them, hey, could you help us out here? Because we've, you know, we're leaning on the Chinese and you're benefiting from it too. But could you buy our stuff? And we're also going to shake you down for whatever it is. So it feels like a shakedown if you're in their position. And it does help to treat your allies like they're getting a special deal. Help you make them think they really are your friends. And you know, it's really, that is really shooting ourselves in the foot, but it's a small thing, but it's evidence. It's an example of how we need to think a little more clearly about, you know, how we're going to carry out this strategy.
You recently wrote a piece entitled America Takes on the Coronavirus. Is Chinese help needed? ? Tell us about it.
Yeah, I wrote it. I wasn't going to, because it's sort of like writing. This was 1,100 words about what is 7 plus 3. But there was a letter which appeared. It was recently, a couple weeks ago, in the U.S., on the East Coast. It was signed by 95 sort of China hands, foreign policy experts, many of them very well known, most U.S. former officials, some politicians, and a lot of academics, mostly Americans, not entirely. And they had written, it was one of these group letters. And their point was, we cannot take on the coronavirus successfully without some degree of cooperation with the People's Republic of China. And, you know, nobody reads these letters is one thing, period. They will look to read who signed it, but people rarely actually read the text. For whatever reason, I read the text to see how they made the case that Chinese cooperation was essential. And I noticed that they hadn't made the case. And there's probably 3 or 4 dozen PhDs on this signatory list, and a couple secretaries of state, et cetera, secretaries of defense. And here they have this letter which says it states a conclusion, but it doesn't make the argument. So I wrote a piece saying, look, they haven't really made the case. And in fact, they've made it the other way, if you read it and think about it, with my point being that we cannot succeed against the coronavirus if we cooperate with the Chinese. The only way we can be successful is to do it on our own and with our friends from the free world, Taiwan included. So that was my point. And one thing you do, and I try to make these about ideas. You know, I didn't mention any names, and I don't like to, because I think ideas rather than personality is what we should be talking about. But I did have to point out that if you looked at the 95 signatories and just very quickly went down the list, there was at least 20 of them who are making a whole lot of money from business with China. And I think you could probably scratch out another 10, 20 on the list as well. And it's generally, if you're going to argue for a policy position, it's pretty good to avoid the appearance that you're getting paid or you're getting personal benefit from a particular policy you're recommending and not sign such letters. So I did have to point that out as well. But it is, once again, part of the equation. So that's what that was about. And once again, this one, I think I explained faster than you could have read it. but that's my point. They really just didn't make the case. I don't think there is a good one to be made, but nonetheless, they should have done much better than that. Maybe the idea was, well, since we're credentialed and we're important people, that the lower orders will take our guidance as they should. So that's what I wrote it about. It turned out, you know, it was a hard one to write for some reason, but it seems to have gotten a pretty good reaction, not by the 95 signatures. Well, they probably won't read the article.
Right, anyway. They wouldn't read it.
But if they did, I don't think they would care for it, because, you know, what would I know?
What's the next subject you're writing about?
Oh, goodness. Some stuff about the Pacific, and then I probably also something about the commandant's sort of guidance, or there's this shift in the Marine Corps trying to add something, offer something that people might not, that doesn't get thought about much. And, you know, talking to you today, I've gotten some ideas. So I'm going to work in the word coveralls as well.
That's from Colonel Hammes. That's what
unusually muscled, tattooed exactly. men in the coveralls
with Groucho Marx glasses and noses on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But, saying nothing to see here.
That's really, it's, you know, to me, that's it's you have to work. If that's what you're going to do, you got to figure out the problem and deal with it.
Well, and again, as you said, you said you don't like to use the phrase, but it's all elements of national power.
Oh, it's synergy.
Right.
It's, and if it is paradigm shifts.
Right.
No, I couldn't resist.
But if it isn't economic power, then you don't really have any place to fall back to, because that's the linchpin in all of this, is they've got to be able to, you know, to raise the level of their boat in that relationship, and then all the other doors come open to you. And so I understand when the president says we've been taken advantage of, but to me, there's difference when you can say, look, we're okay being taken advantage of here, because you might as well put those dollars in the DOD, because that's what we're paying to have access to this region, which is a deterrent to a much worse fate. And so that's how that works. And so to me, if he doesn't want to do the Trans-Pacific Partnership, then cut bilateral agreements, you know, with those countries and make them our friends, so that they can be permissive, you know, environment. So we can have our own version of little green men in the region all the time, as opposed to kind of, you know, staring at the candy through the candy store window. How long are you in Taiwan? Will you be there until the foreseeable future? Are you going to head back to Hawaii?
Oh, I'll be out here for a while. There's nowhere that will have me. These days, and, you know, I'm not sure why anyone would want to go back to the U.S. at the moment. It would be voluntarily submitting to incarceration. I don't think I could bear the nuttiness which is ongoing
right.
at the moment.
It's not so.
I can't imagine that you're liking it either.
Well, it's not unlike being aboard ship. It's Groundhog Day. I've done it before, so it's not that difficult. I can do it, and I have a gym at my house, so I'm all right. How has Taiwan handled it?
Oh, pretty well. Hairs are not a light. You don't have a guy named Newsom telling people they're all going to die if they don't do what he says. It's be surprised actually just how sort of normal the whole thing is. Normal, but it's not this sort of self-inflicted terror that the Americans seem to be fond of implementing. You can actually go out to like a restaurant. You could actually it doesn't seem like the end of the world. They've handled it well, so.
All right, sir. First of all, I appreciate your time as always, and thank you very much for making us smart. And until we speak again, all the best of luck.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Always enjoy it.
All right. There you have it. That is Grant Newsham from the other side of the world late at night. So we always appreciate Grant staying up late for us. On a Tuesday, that'll do it. I think we're going to talk about Kantian tomorrow. Yeah. So Daryl Horn is supposed to join us. He from Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, during Operation Buffalo in the DMZ. Yeah. So hopefully you'll hear Daryl tomorrow. If you're just tuning in the first hour, talk about the joy of when there's a lot of bad news, but the joy of home projects, cleaning gutters, cleaning your garage, right? Planting the flowers and all the things that we tend to put off. Well, you have a perfect opportunity to do that stuff now. And for me, I love to clean. It makes me happy. So I would just encourage you, get after those projects, whether it be like all the pictures in your closet you wanted to either put in order or scan them or whatever. Do that stuff. Yeah. Do that stuff. And somebody sent me an email. Mac, I scanned a bunch of my pictures myself. Here's how I do it. I categorize pictures in three categories. One, mandatory that I keep and scan. Two, essential that I keep and scan. And three, nice to keep and scan. I'm proud to say that every picture that was in the essential is now digitized. I'm probably about halfway through the essential pile too. So it can be done. You don't have to do it all in one day, but I would recommend it. I've shared them with my kids, and they are absolutely overjoyed that I did it. So it can be done at home. All the best. So there you go. It can be done at home. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about coming out of this thing. That mayors and governors ought to be the people, governors primarily, and then mayors within the states, tweaking how different parts of this country come out. Because, again, not everybody's New York City. In fact, most of us are not. So we talk about that a little bit, and then we check out the news of the day. And then if you're just joining us, Grant Newsham, talking about, will China pay? And talk about Taiwan and Taiwan's beef with the World Health Organization. And I think what it's done to the credibility, of Taiwan around the world. And, Taiwan stands out there in silence. What, 18 million people in silence? Because that's the way China wants it, which is bullshit. And so that's been kind of interesting to watch. And then American engagement, we talk about it on the program, but the Navy pivoting to the Pacific, the Marine Corps pivoting to the Pacific, the Army pivoting to the Pacific. But nobody, you know, Thailand, the only one that hosts a joint exercise with the United States. In a non-permissive environment, how do you do it? So that's a problem. Yet you don't see that discussed at the national level that we're going to have to engage those nations first economically. We want to have a great economic relationship with you, and we want to introduce you to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world needs us to be invested in your part of the world for our own safety, for the safety of the rules-based order, because that's what's at stake here. China's attempt to usurp the rules-based order, which the rest of the world cannot allow that. Yeah. Cannot. So, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow on a Wednesday. All right. But for Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.